in France right through the whole of the 4 years of the Second World War, and she joined the resistance right at the beginning, almost before the Nazis arrived in France. My mother was always ahead of the game. I wrote the book, as Claire said, because she suffered from Alzheimer's for 20 years, and it was my way of working it through. It was also my way of showing that people who had amazing lives did extraordinary things but fall prey to this horrendous disease. When the Nazis invaded Paris, Andre was working at police headquarters. She was working at the passport in the passport and ID department. And as the Nazis took over police headquarters, she had to remain there. You had to stay in your job if you were a civil servant. And she used the opportunity to steal ID cards from police headquarters to pass them on to the Jews who were trying to escape France. But she also used her position to obtain the Auschwitz, the permits, which were necessary to travel around France during the occupation, and which enabled her to do her work as a courier in the French resistance. My story is very much a family story because it involved my grandmother, who worked for British intelligence during the First World War, and then come on the Second World War, my uncle, aged 17, decided he couldn't stand around and do nothing, and he decided to start up an underground newspaper. The point of the newspaper was to entice the French to resist the occupation and to tell them what was going on politically. So he had his newspaper, that was fine, but he had no money. He was only 17. Where did he get the money? For ink, for paper, for Rolleiflex machines. And he thought to himself, well, we'll get Andre. Andre's at police headquarters. We won't worry about the fact the place is absolutely crawling with Nazis. The next thing he did was he started up his own resistance group. He was only 18. He was one group, eventually was one of only 200 recognised by the government at the end of the war. So it was an important group. They were working for the intelligence services, the Allies, both the British, the Americans, and the French. My mother became the lead courier of the group. They were working directly for General de Gaulle in London via the head of the resistance in Algeria, French North Africa. My book very much takes you through the Second World War, through the eyes of my mother, through her journals, which she kept and wrote throughout the war, which is quite an extraordinary thing to have done. I edited them, I translated them, but obviously it was very dangerous to keep these diaries going. And what a lot of people have said is that it's the journals that really brings the story to life. She was arrested. There are several chapters about different things. There's a chapter about her arrest, where she was interrogated by the Gestapo. She talked her way out of it. As a result, she was given the military cross, the Croix de Guerre, the French Croix de Guerre, and she eventually got the Legion of Honour. There's a chapter about how she had to stay the night in a brothel frequented by Nazis. She had to take a sack of gold coins back to Paris from Bordeaux, which she managed to get herself a girdle and tie up these coins into the girdle. There's a chapter about her taking a French general out to lunch, one about the Jewish guest. My grandmother had a Jewish guest to stay for several months during right at the centre of the war. There's one about scarlet fever, where she plays the RAF march past and doesn't worry about anybody in the neighbourhood hearing it. And then finally, amongst other chapters, there's one about my father arriving in the RAF. And I had a whole chapter on that, which was so exciting because I wanted to bring my father into the book as I wrote it. And every time I brought him in, my editor said, it's nothing to do with your father. This is a story about the French resistance. So at the end of the book, I got my bit in. Thank you.
Just because you mentioned brothels, I kept reading this, and there are various things that kept up coming up in both books. I don't think these women would ever have met each other, although had they met each other in the field, they wouldn't have known, because they're all undercover anyhow, and they weren't going to talk about it. But there are lots of connections, so they both worked with people from SOE, but they both also worked with people from OSS, which is the American equivalent of SOE, based on the SOE, so sending the special agents in to support and work with the resistance. But they also both mentioned brothels in different ways as well. Do you want to just briefly mention, firstly?
Virginia's very first recruits were nuns in a convent, which was her first safe house. And she went from one end of the morality spectrum to the other. And her chief lieutenant was Germaine Guérin, who was the most amazingly glamorous brothel madam in Lyon. She was famous for her couture, her furs, her jewels, her silks, and this little menagerie of black cats that followed her everywhere. And she was making a lot of money after the war. She was entertaining German officers. They were encouraged by their commanders to visit brothels. It was thought to make them better fighters. So she was making a lot of money, but what she was actually doing was using that as a means of helping the resistance, because she was using part of her brothel under the very noses of those German officers to hide agents on the run, people in trouble, downed RAF pilots. But she was also, with Virginia's help, she managed to persuade the prostitutes, the poor girls, to spike the client's drinks with drugs so that they fell asleep, and then they would rifle through their uniforms, find any important documents, take photographs of them, pass them on to Virginia. Lots of great intelligence came that way. But they also did something else. They recruited the local VD doctor, who gave them little white cards denoting them to be free of infection when they were anything but. And their job was to sleep with as many German officers as they possibly could before they went and got treatment themselves. And this was, if you like, a very personal, unorthodox certainly, but effective form of biological warfare. And, you know, they put dozens of German officers out of action, helped also by consignments of itching powder that Virginia arranged to be brought in from London, which would increase the discomfort of those German officers. And, you know, a lot of those prostitutes they didn't start off wanting to be sex workers, as we would call them now. A lot of them were working that way because their husbands had been killed or captured. They had lost their own jobs. At least she didn't like women working. They wanted them to stay at home and have at least four babies. That was sort of the conservative way of life that Vichy was promoting. They had no other way of feeding their kids. And so they would take up this profession, the oldest profession, simply to keep the wolf from the door. So the fact that they were doing these amazingly brave things, and a lot of them, whose names we will never know, got caught, tortured, and shot. This was dangerous, what they were doing, extremely dangerous. A lot of them died. And then, even at the end of the war, of course, they were blamed quite often by their own side. You slept with the enemy. And they would be, beaten up, shaved, ostracized. And yet they had been doing this very, very brave work. And Virginia, at least, she called them my tart friends. And I'm pleased to say that I managed to get this one document, I've got several documents declassified, but one of them was a British government document. And she wrote to the British government and said she remained around after the war because she ended up in Ravensbrück, the concentration camp. She got caught. She sacrificed herself so that two Asians could get away. She was caught. She nearly died. She was really in a bad state and destitute of narcissistic everything from her. And Virginia wrote, she lobbied the British government, you've got to do something about Germaine Garin, because the French wouldn't help her, because she'd worked for a foreign power, i.e. us, they wouldn't help her at all. And I'm pleased to say that to the end of her days, the British government paid her an unofficial pension for her war work. So the money went straight from Whitehall into her old brothel premises, which is probably an unusual transaction, an interesting one.
And Andre had her own very different experience as well.
It's slightly different by my experience with brothels. She, as a courier, she was always travelling around France. There are huge descriptions in her journals of her travelling around France during the war. And, of course, the railway tracks had been bombed, so you couldn't just get from A to B, very simply, because the railway tracks had been weren't working. So, inevitably, you'd arrive so late at night somewhere. And on one particular occasion, which I write about in the book, she arrived so late that the last... she couldn't get another train out of the town, and curfew had fallen, so she had to go and stay somewhere. And she writes she couldn't find anywhere to stay because all the hotels were full. And so she thought to herself, what on earth am I going to do? And working at police headquarters, I assume this is why she worked this out, she decided to go to the local police station. And she was hoping, I think, that the police would invite her in to stay, either with their family, or they might invite her in to a cell for the night. But no luck. They decided they would send her to a brothel. And I remember her telling me the story that, so the guy said, well, we've got a safe house. We know the lady who runs it. You'll be absolutely fine. And so she goes there and she spends the night. But you can imagine it wasn't very pleasant. She was 20, 21 when this happened. She was put in a room, but she could hear what was going on. She has a fight, which she writes two pages about, with a flea. It was one of those things that she carried on talking to me about when I was a child, whenever my room was in a mess. I was told about this flea and this brothel. I think it left a very unpleasant feeling. And then on one occasion when she left the brothel, she got up very early because she knew that curfew was lifted. And she bumped into a Nazi officer, kind of paying his bill or arguing about his bill as she was leaving. And he demanded to see her passport or her ID card. And he saw that she was working at police headquarters. So yet again, that saved her.
And the brothel saved her too. Well, the brothel was actually not on my notes, so we're going to go back. I couldn't resist that one. But you talked a bit about your research there, and of course it struck me that you have very different books, because yours is a biography and yours is a memoir rather than a personal, and that means that you have very different sources as well. So perhaps, Marcel, will you kick off? I mean, obviously your main source was your mother and her diaries, her journals.
Yes.
But also interviews with other family members.
Yes, I had a lot of sources. My uncle, who headed the resistance group, I think it was in 1992, he commissioned, or somebody wanted to write a story about his resistance group in French. So there's several books written in French about the group, so that was a very big source for me of what had happened, what was going on. I also had two of my mother's friends, one who's 99 today, he is absolutely on, completely knows what's going on, and he helped me a lot with the book. I asked him a lot of questions. He talked to me about when he was, he gathered the intelligence and he'd phone up my mother at police headquarters and dictate the intelligence over the phone. And he said to me, he said, your mother sometimes would say, it's very, very cold in here. He said, I knew I had to get off the phone on the double. So that was the second source of the people that I was able to talk to. My mother talked a lot about it when I was younger. But it was mainly, when she talked about it, it was mainly the small stories. It wasn't the bigger picture. It was sort of the brothel. It was her hatred of the Germans, her humiliating the Germans, how she managed to get away with that sort of thing. It wasn't the big picture. And so the books that have been written that helped me with that.
Was it difficult because you were so close to the story? I mean, the nice thing is that you have your mother's diaries, and so they're very personal. She talks about her food and the boys and, you know, lots of teenage girls' concerns, war or no war. But for you, were there sensitivities? Were there family sensitivities?
There were quite a few sensitive issues, yeah. Some of it I obviously didn't include. I kept out all the stories about the boyfriends. My editor kept saying, she must have had a boyfriend who was in the resistance with her. You've got to write about him. And I said, no, there's absolutely no way, because they never spoke about what they were up to. I think it's slightly different with SOE, where they knew a bit more about what the others were up to. My uncle's cardinal rule was, you never knew more than the next one in the line, so that like that it was secure. They based the group, my uncle based his group on Sinn Féin for a number of reasons. He knew how they operated.
SOE was based on Sinn Féin as well.
Yeah.
Some of you obviously faced different challenges. I mean, I know that you went to the British archives, went to the French archives. I understand you went through 9 levels of security at Langley to get into the CIA.
Yes, I managed to get into the CIA, which was fantastic. They held a lot of information about me. I spent a day at Langley, which was slightly bizarre, but also really fun. That was good, and they told me that I believe it was 9 levels of security, but there'd been one non-conquer, as they called it, and I said, oh, well, how come I'm here then? And they said, oh, you've got a friend high up in the CIA who said, don't worry about it. I've no idea who this friend is or why he or she said, don't worry. But anyway, I managed to get in, and they were telling me so much of what they do now. Today, the CIA is still based on what Virginia Hall pioneered in terms of being a special forces agent behind enemy lines back then in the 1940s. So that was interesting. Some of the French files I discovered, particularly in Lyon, which was her base in France, were extraordinary. This whole treasure trove covered in dust, literally had to get rid of the dust. But found these letters between themselves, the Maquisards that had fought with her, writing things saying that it'd been worth being born just to have met Virginia Hall and to have fought alongside her. Extraordinary descriptions of what they'd done, pictures of the bridges that they'd blown up together, some of which are in the book, in descriptions of the missions that she organised and directed them on. So that was exceptional too. And I also found her niece, her really sole remaining relative who remembers her well, who's now 89, who managed to fill in some of the gaps for me. Because, you know, Virginia didn't make it easy. She had 20 different code names during the war alone. And I had to work out these 20 different people were the same Virginia. And that took a while, quite a lot of detective work. And then in Britain too, I managed to get some files declassified here and in the States. And in some of those files, you know, I found the most incredible things. And there's descriptions of, she became this jailbreak ace, for instance. And we've all heard of The Great Escape and watched it every Christmas. And we all know that, you know, those prisoners, most of them didn't make it. I mean, that's the kind of the gist of the story. But she got dozens of agents out and got them back to Britain. And yet we know nothing. And one particular, one incredibly spectacular jailbreak she did in Mozac and in the Dordogne, where she got 12 agents out at once. The chapter's called 12 Minutes, 12 Men. She got them all out, 12 minutes, that's all she had, to get them through the barbed wire, out of the searchlights, into a lorry and off. All 12 got out, all 12 got to the safe house, and all 12 got back to Britain. And she did this with all sorts of extraordinary techniques which came out in the files, including drafting in a priest with no legs at all. She had one, this guy had no legs because of the First World War. And he went in to give visits to the pastoral visits to the prisons. But under his cassock, where his legs should have been, there was a radio transmitter. She managed to get one in. It's you know, almost stand hello, this is all real. You know, she got files in and pots of jam. She got hammers in and hollowed out books. She smuggled in through a doctor's sleeping draughts and things, and she got those guys out. And this was all in these files, and no one had ever known about this before, but the files say that, this is SOE files, many of our men owe their lives to Virginia Hall, and yet she's virtually unknown. One of these women that just gets overlooked by history.
When I was reading your book, it was quite late, and then I got to that chapter, and I just need to forget it. Like, I've powered on to Mormon. It was great. When I was researching, I did find, you know, we have inherent difficulties, don't we? We're looking at female secret agents and women in resistance, and there is that problem secret. But for me, sometimes it was the gaps in the archive that were quite telling. Were there things that you couldn't find that was also revealing in a different way?
I suppose that she didn't talk about her own feelings very much. She did right at the beginning, but you can tell from the situation reports that she sent back to London how she matures as an agent, if you like. How initially she's quite cross because all the male agents had wives and people sort of thinking about them, and she felt very, very lonely. And the one time that her mother was allowed to send her something one Christmas, because they're all starving, there's actually no food, her mother sends her a Christmas cake, doesn't know where she is, but sends it through SOE, and the Christmas cake never arrives, and she, you know, she doesn't swear at this point, she goes, oh gosh, and darn, this is bad. And then later on, in the situation reports, the swearing is fairly full on, and you can tell this is a woman who started off quite sort of nice and chatty, and it gets sort of quite a hard bitten in a way. But then in those letters I found in Lyon, you see little glimpses that they talk about, where one evening they'd have these Maquisards, these guys who lived in the mountains with no food, no shoes, you know, for 18 months, and there they are taking command from a foreign woman who rocks out from nowhere, no idea who she is, but seems to know what she's doing. And then she has a cup of tea with them, and she tells them that she's a little bit homesick, and you just suddenly get these little glimpses. And I just wish I knew more about what was going through her head. I see those glimpses. Mm. We will never know, because the reason why she survived is because she never let on.
She
yeah.
Which asks a couple of questions here for you. I mean, obviously, Andre kept a diary, and there must be in her risk involved in that. I was very curious as to why she'd have done that. But also in her diary, some of the things she writes, you know, obviously some of the Germans who are working, the Nazi Germans working in the police station, ask her out for dinner, and she's saying no, no, no. And she says in her diary, you know, you couldn't have dinner with a German. But she does, doesn't she? But she writes about it. So.
Yeah. Well, the diaries are interesting. They start when she was 9 years old, and they carry on until she got married. And yeah, I mean, I'm often asked about the diaries, and I don't know how to explain it, how she wrote about them. I mean, in one entry, she's at police headquarters, I think it's a Sunday, she's running the passport department, and she writes in her book, "I'm so bored, I'm so depressed, I've got no boyfriend, and I hate the Germans, I hate them so much, I'll never be able to say it enough times." And then she says, "I could be shot for writing this." I mean, that's what was so extraordinary. The other thing I find extraordinary is that she wrote about these trips that she went round France, these trips which some people say to me, how did she get so much time off work? Well, she got a lot of time off work because there was a passive resistance in France, and people talk about that. You do something, you disappear from work for 4 days, and no one would ever question where you'd been or what you'd been up to because they thought we might be up to something. Yeah, there's all sorts of things in the journals. I mean, the boyfriend, yeah, the she swore blind, absolutely swore blind that she'd never been out with a German. And you just didn't fraternise with the enemy. But she was working at police headquarters amongst the Germans. I think there's a myth today that people think how nasty the Germans were in Paris, they were evil. And they were. My mother used to say, if you behaved yourself, it was fine.
And weren't Jewish.
And you weren't Jewish, yeah, obviously. But if you behaved yourself, they left you alone. So she was there working with them. She probably helped them with administrative things. She had to. It was part of her job. But my 99-year-old says to me, you've got to realise that we had been invaded. We had to get on with them. The country had to operate. And in Paris, they behaved, apparently. That's what he says. They behaved towards, especially towards the women. The men had only to stand on the street corner and they'd be searched, but the women were not searched. Women were not searched. And so I suppose she probably thought that she'd never be searched, her diaries would never be read. She also, apart from the journals, she had little diaries, what they call in France, annuaires, which are where you put times and dates. And it's extraordinary. There's a list of phone numbers. I mean, and names, and I can't quite relate the names and the phone numbers. I don't know the people, so maybe they were just friends. But there are times of trains where she's going. I mean, it's extraordinary. And yet this is a woman who is so, so cautious, who never spoke to anybody, who, you know, there was...
She did also go out for dinner with a German once, didn't she? But to very good effect.
Yes. Yes, she was trying to get one of her friends, or one of the group, had been arrested. And they were trying to get him off one of the last trains that was going to Germany. And the idea was to take this German general out to lunch. That's what I meant about the general, which I said earlier. And it was a very, very complicated story to work out because she told me about taking this German general out. I remember when I was in my early 20s, but I didn't really listen to the story terribly. And basically, they had to bribe this general, and there was a lot of money involved, which had been given by the CIA to get this boy off the train. But they had to find the train timetable. They had to find out when he was going to be taken to the station from wherever the holding camp. And so one of the Germans at police headquarters, who she obviously knew very well, she said to him, you know, could you help me? I mean, she was basically forthright with him. And what one also forgets is that not all Wehrmacht officers were Nazis. So some of them were prepared to help. You know, they were prepared to help her. It's quite complicated to explain. But that is what happened. And I think this story in the book about the German general, I think that the general was gay. I think that her friend, who they were trying to get off the train, was gay. I think her colleague, who was part of the team getting off the guy off the train, was also gay. I think it was sort of, that's how I explained it.
But there were obviously things that women could do that men couldn't in the resistance. So Sonia, so, I mean, like with SOE alone, we know that 39 women were sent into France, just France. And of those 13, never came home. Obviously, Virginia Hall was one of the earliest being sent into France. Can you talk a bit about why gender was important to her in her role, and the inherent, not just the advantages, but some of the risks associated with that as well?
Well, initially, I think it was an advantage. She went in initially undercover as an American journalist, so she filed articles for the New York Post, and they had, at that point, no other way of contacting London, so she had to put coded messages in articles in the New York Post, and an SOE in London would buy copies of the newspaper, and that was the only means of communication for some time that they had. It was really amazing. And then she set up this thing through the American consulate and the diplomatic bag went into Switzerland and into London. But initially it was thought that the Germans and the Vichy police, because we mustn't forget the Vichy police, they were just as vicious, if not more so, than the Gestapo. In fact, they used to vie with each other to be more brutal. Both of them initially thought, because of their conservative ways, that women, women involved in that nasty, dirty resistance business, that must be crazy. But then they worked out pretty quickly that a lot of women were, in fact, couriers, and they would be carrying secrets and names and networks and rendezvous in their heads. So if you caught them going through a patrol, maybe with something incriminating, maybe with a gun, maybe some bullets, maybe with some documents, some maps or something, they devised their most brutal methods of torture for women, both the French and the Germans. I won't go into them, but they were just utterly barbaric. And after a while, the Germans and the French worked out that there was this super agent somewhere in France, in Lille. They started closing in. He was able to keep the resistance alive, and all these arrests were taking place. They worked out, after time, through double agents, through intercepting messages, through torture, that it was a woman, and then they found out it was a limping woman, because of course she limped with her wooden leg. And then they had this double agent, a priest, another priest, a bad priest in this case, who managed to infiltrate her network, one of the worst double agents of the war, Robert Alesh, who, and by the time he got that close to her, she had to flee. And this is when she went over the Pyrenees in November 1942, in some of the heaviest snows in 200 years, over one of the highest passes, because no one would think that anyone, let alone a woman with a wooden leg, would even try that pass. Are you crazy? But she did, with the Gestapo on her heels, and she made it over, even though Cuthbert, the rivets were working loose towards the end, because she couldn't flex or extend her ankle. She had to go up sideways, up virtually vertical pass, two able-bodied men who virtually collapsed. She had to keep them all going. So she got out.
Can you just tell that story associated with about her wirelessing Britain?
Oh yeah. So she had this really heavy bag with a wireless in it, and they stopped in a shepherd's hut halfway up, and she messaged Britain, you know, saying that she was on her way out, and saying Cuthbert is troublesome, but I can manage. Well, the duty officer that night, normally they would know who Cuthbert was, but the duty officer that night didn't, and signalled back, "Have him eliminated then." a small moment of humour in quite a dark episode. Yeah, it's a great one.
Before we open it up for questions for the audience, we talked a bit about the danger. We talked, sometimes I think when, even today, I read new books that are written about female special agents or women in the resistance more broadly, and they tend to romanticise them. Mm-hmm. I've seen short story collections where they start, the thing that attracted us to this story was her beautiful smile and this sort of thing. And I think it's important, your books don't do this. Could you talk a little bit about how it's important to revise that history? I think it is a start. I think there are more better books these days, but it's very important we remember this history in the right way. And perhaps in that, just briefly mention perhaps what you think the biggest achievement was, because I think women tend to be celebrated for their courage and sometimes for paying the ultimate price, which of course we do need to remember and honour. But less is mentioned about what they actually achieved. And with the woman I wrote about, Christina Scarbett, and the other women, of course they achieved a huge amount. So, Sonia first.
Well, I mean, Virginia got all those men out of jail. She fanned the flames of resistance when resistance didn't really exist in France at that point. I mean, one guy spent 3 months with a former French army officer trying to put a band of people together. He managed to get five after 3 months of trying. So she really got things going. She created Lyon as a resistance hub. And then when she came back on her second mission, she armed, organised, directed and trained hundreds, if not thousands, of Maquis to isolate and ambush German convoys, to blow up bridges, and to stop reinforcements getting up to Normandy and reinforcing the German defences up there. She supplied intelligence that the American army announced in the 1980s had been, quote, vital, and had helped the Allied armies capture or corner the German armies outside Paris and enabled them to liberate Paris. Virginia was that important. And finally, she, with her own Maquis up in the Haute-Loire, liberated an entire department of France, took 600 German soldiers prisoner after isolating their garrison until they surrendered. Without a single professional soldier, the Allies were still up in northern France, trapped up there. It was an extraordinary achievement. These were schoolboys, 17-year-olds, one of her closest guys, Gabrielle, who died in just 2017, vets, booksellers, lots of booksellers. I don't know about booking people, but they make really good Maquis. She got them together. These were peasant squads, if you like, some of them called themselves that. And they did that. This doesn't get written about. These people, Eisenhower said at the time, they'd shorten the war by 9 months at least. They were incredibly brave, but they hadn't had anyone to lead them or arm them or organise them before. And that's what she did. And as a result, she was awarded the Distinguished Service Cross by America. It's the second highest medal. She was the only civilian woman in the whole of World War II to be given that honour. And President Truman himself wanted to give it to her, the White House. And she wrote back and said, "No, thank you, Mr. President. You see, I want to go on being a secret agent after the war, and I don't want the publicity." And she did indeed go on to work for the CIA, and it's that sort of modesty that perhaps meant that it's taken until now to find out all about her.
Oh, I'm so glad you did that. Awesome.
No, I think it's interesting to point out, and I'm just talking about France and England, that in England we got the vote in, when was it? I ought to know.
1918.
In France, 1918 in the UK, in France, they didn't get the vote until 1944. Until 1944, they could not vote, and they could not even have bank accounts without their father's permission. From my mother's point of view, being in the resistance was nothing about bravery. It was something that just had to be done. It was nothing about whether you were a woman or not. She was there, her country had been invaded, the Germans weren't meant to be there, no ifs nor buts, they just had to go. And she used to say we would have done anything to get rid of them, and anything for de Gaulle. I think she was unusual in that, having done these extraordinary things during the war, she then came to England, got married, and was a housewife for 18 years. Housewives are very important, but having done what she'd done, she then does that. Unusually, my father died when she was only 45, and she took over his business. So she put that kind of, she was probably one of the first women in business in the United Kingdom, in a very hard sort of work where she was dealing with truckers, she was dealing with dockers and this sort of thing. So.
And I'm just going to fly a quick flag for Christina as well, because she is another fantastic example of what women achieved. So. She was the first female special agent for SOE, but not the first into France. She was sent first into occupied Poland, where they were desperate to find out what was going on. And her first big achievement was she smuggled out hidden microfilm, hidden inside her gloves, skied across the borders, the frontiers, and managed to get that microfilm, handed it over in Sofia to a British air attaché. He took it back to Churchill, landed on Churchill's desk, and that was the first film footage of Operation Barbarossa, the Nazi. It was basically footage of the amassing of tanks and troops on what was then the German side of the German-Soviet border, at which point Churchill told his daughter that Christine was his favourite spy. I'm sure Menzies was his favourite spy, really, but at that moment, certainly, she was. And then she was deployed, she served in three different theatres of war. Then she was deployed in Egypt and the Middle East, and then she was dropped into occupied France from Algiers, and she actually trained in Club des Pins, where brother's circuit, Orion circuit, were trained there as well. Yeah. And then served in France, just for the D-Day in the south. where again, I mean, she was doing this extraordinary work, working with the local resistance groups. She single-handedly secured the defection of an entire German garrison on a strategic pass in the Alps, and she saved the lives of three of her fellow officers, including Michael Morpurgo's uncle, which is quite good, and various other achievements as well. And yet, at the end of the war, again, it took a lot of hard work to get any recognition for her. I mean, the British government treated her poorly, because she was actually Jewish-born, but she'd put her life on the line for 6 years for Britain, directly serving the British crown. And then they left her high and dry in Cairo and didn't give her citizenship. And as a Pole, she couldn't go back to Poland because it had this Soviet-backed communist regime. They would have shot her immediately. In fact, Britain had swapped her details for the details of a NKVD agent earlier on, so they'd have known exactly who she was. And when they offered her her honours, she refused to accept them unless they agreed to give her British citizenship, which they did. So she had to shame them into giving it. So these stories about how they received their honours just... much, much more we could talk about, but I'm being weighed out, so we need to have some questions. I believe there are some people with microphones, so please hang on and wait for the mic to come to you. Anyone got a question? There's a lady on the left there.
Yes.
Hang on a second. What was that like?
Are you saying me or not?
Yes.
All right. I got quite a loud voice. No. Right, okay. Basically, did I hear right that in fact there were 200 resistance groups you mentioned earlier on?
Yes.
And how did it all work? Did they work independently? How did they all work?
Well, there were 200 resistance groups recognised at the end of the Second World War by the French government. I don't really know whether by the British government, because some of them were SOE groups, so it must have been the French government who were recognising them. How were they recognised? I assume it was the military that recognised them, Val de Gaulle.
Do you mean how they recognised with their arms?
No, not at all. How did they work? Did they work with one another, or did they work independently?
No, those 200 resistance groups, some of them would have worked together, but some of them would have worked independently of each other.
Part of the role of SOE was to provide communications and to help coordinate. So, like you said, they were based on the IRA, so they're all cellular. And so each cell would have three key people brought in by SOE, a circuit leader, a wireless transmitter, and a courier. The courier and quite often the wireless transmitters were women because they could move much more freely around behind enemy lines without being picked up, because especially after the SPO, the service provide obligatoire, came in, where able-bodied young men were required to work for the war effort for Nazi Germany, so either in French factories making aircraft or whatever, or back in Germany. So they were very suspect, whereas women were travelling around all the time trying to support their families and run businesses and things. So women became very useful. And these networks couldn't, the idea was that they're all separate, so that if one fell, it wouldn't bring down the next one. But they could all coordinate through the SOE backgrounds and the OSS backgrounds and the RF. So de Gaulle also ran a separate group called RF, as opposed to the F, the French section SOE ran. But they liaised through London, so they can wireless back to the UK, and the UK's got an overall idea of what's happening with everyone. So then, for example, in the run-up to D-Day, there were, I think, 193 messages within the first 24 hours over the BBC, and basically told which groups, which thoroughfares they had to keep open, which ones they had to stop to corral the German forces, which train lines had to go down, which fuel and ammunition dumps had to go up at that moment so the Germans couldn't send forces up to Normandy. So it's really coordinated, but from Britain, not by each other.
Thank you very much.
There's a lady here. Thank you.
I think, although these women are fantastic and the role of SOE is so important, I think, as André was trying to suggest, quite a lot of resistance took place within France without SOE. And, we need to perhaps think about the role of the Communist Party, the role of very ordinary people who were involved in this without SOE, and SOE perhaps operating in particular ways. I was very interested, though, to know what happened to these women after the war, and you began to talk about that, because it must be so difficult to forget about what you've been doing and to live a life which is apparently ordinary, and I wonder if you could both say a little bit more about that.
It's
I think just to talk about the French resistance, if you like, for a second. Including the communists, who were extremely brave and well organised, but the problem is they didn't have any guns. So they were fighting with broom handles and kitchen knives, and it was really only SOE that could bring in the explosives, the guns, the ammunition, the vitamins. They all lived on benzodrine, by the way, amphetamines that kept them going night after night. Shoes, often they had no shoes, they were running around in bare feet. So although there were these French resistance organisations, they relied hugely on SOE and all those very brave RAF crews coming in and dropping these supplies in big metal cylinders made by the Gasboard in Croydon. And you see on some of the little stamped Gasboard Croydon, and you think, well, how sort of bizarre that must have been. But those women who did so much after the war, you know, well, I mean, a lot of them, of course, ended up in Ravensbrück, one of the worst concentration camps. Again, the Nazis reserved some of their most brutal treatment. I mean, what they did to those women, they injected them with gangrene, they did all sorts of things. A lot of them died there. Those that came back, like Germaine Garin, the brothel man, and they were never the same again. And they often, particularly those who've done a great deal, refuse to talk about what they did. And again, I think this is why we know so little about the role of women, because they didn't write it down, they didn't, apart from Pascal's mother, but that's really unusual, most of them didn't write it down, they didn't tell people. And after the war, it was almost, I mean, I know this from my own father, who fought in the war, he didn't want to talk about it either. It was a way, perhaps, of dealing with it, because of course, we would now say they all had PTSD, I'm sure, and I'm sure a lot of them did. But how they dealt with it then was almost containing it. It was a box they wanted to shut for decades at least. And I think that is another reason why we don't know about them. And France, so I recognise it so much. As I, you know, so many of them said, I wasn't brave, I just did what I had to do, and I'm not going to tell you anymore.
It was a very interesting documentary. The French are always trying to promote the resistance and what the resistance did, for obvious reasons. And there was a very interesting documentary done in France, I think it was a four-part documentary, on the resistance, where they were showing that just about everybody in France resisted, for want of a better word, the occupation. But in small ways, okay, some of them obviously were collaborators, and that's another side of it. But very ordinary people. I mean, for example, when the Nazis went into Paris, people would, for example, just cross the road and not be on the same side of the street as the Nazis. That was a form of resistance. You know, we think about the horrendous number of Jewish people who lost their lives, but of 330,000 Jewish people living in France at the beginning of the war, there were 260,000 still living at the end of the war. How come these people carried on? Because there were people all over France, such as my grandmother, who didn't talk about it, they just took them in. And there were an awful lot of people doing just very, very simple things, but resisting the occupation. Mm.
Any other questions? I've just then mentioned a little bit about Christine, because you also talked about how they coped after the war, and I think you're absolutely right, there was a lot, an awful lot of trauma. And I know I've got friends who were in the Fannings, and some of them did receive some amount of kind of early counselling, or they were put on art courses, things like that, but it was a lot of conversation and working through sort of thing. But the agents weren't, they weren't given any of that. And I know from Christine's experience, she, again, wanted to continue her service after the war, because she wasn't with the OSS, she was with SOE. And SOE wouldn't have her, partly because she was female, partly because they thought she was slightly bit of a loose cannon. There is some possibility of that. But also partly because she was Jewish, and after the Camp David bomb, they wouldn't have anyone that they thought might have conflicting loyalties. I don't think that was an issue with her at all. But if you read her last reports, in fact, the very last report in the British Files, because she wrote for Britain, it's all in Q, there's a line in there, and it says, she is no longer wanted. That's you know, they were just dumped. And all the men she worked with were given other roles. You know, one of her lovers, her most important life partner, let's say, ended up serving in occupied Germany after the war, you know, in the Allied zone, in the British zone. But none of that was offered to the women. They were just, if you didn't want to become a secretary, and that's not the skills these women had, you know, they were completely dumped, and it was incredibly hard for them.
I mean, the same with Virginia in the CIA. She was one of the first female officers of the CIA. And I managed to get hold of all the personnel files about her. It's heartbreaking reading. Mm. She was sidelined, she was belittled, she was forced to report to a male officer two ranks her junior. All these sorts of complete ways of undermining someone, making them feel undervalued. And, you know, she retired in the end, having really had quite an unsatisfactory career at the CIA. Ironically, now, of course, they say, our missions are based on Virginia Hall, and yes, we have a whole module about what she did in our training program, and yes, we have now named a building after her. And then when Gina Haspel became the first ever female director of the CIA last year, she gave this speech, rather bizarrely, with Trump and Pence behind her shoulders here, and she talked about the fact she was the first female officer director of the CIA. She said that it had been made possible only because, and these are her words, that I stood on the shoulders of heroines who had gone before me in CIA and OSS, which Virginia had worked in, who battered down those prejudices and those barriers, and without whom I wouldn't be here today. And she didn't mention Virginia, but everyone at CIA I've spoken to said, well, you know, that was obviously who she was talking about. So she's become the poster girl now at the CIA of equality in disability, equality in gender, but it's taken a long time really for them to understand this.
And even in those files, when they refer to Virginia Hall, they put Virginia Hall and then they refer to her as he.
Yeah, they do.
And tell us about the petticoat panel.
Oh, yeah, so in the 1950s, they realised, and a new director, another male director, funny enough, another ex-OSS director came in and realised that women in the CIA were forced to go in white gloves. These were, you know, there were many women like Virginia, but Virginia, the woman who'd blown up bridges and been a commander leader, was forced to wear white gloves to go into work. And there was a lot of unhappiness about the way they were treated. So he set up a panel of women to look at why they were so badly treated in the CIA, and they called it the Petticoat Panel. And they said, none of these women are taken seriously, but the only concession really that was given, they were allowed to start using the gym, but only on 2 days a week, and only in certain hours. You know, so nothing ever really changed. And some of you might have heard of E. Howard Hunt. He was a bit of a baddie in the Watergate saga and was CIA and actually went to prison. But in this, he was actually a goodie. And I found something that he wrote about Virginia Hall, describing her as a sacred presence, belittled, undermined, and put in a corner by these bureaucrats, these non-combatant types. And he actually railed at her treatment, saying how appalling it was that she'd been treated in such a way that she wasn't given mission, she wasn't given proper interesting stuff to get her teeth into. And it is a tragedy. And one of the ways she dealt with it, I'm afraid, is she probably drank too much. A lot of those people drank, because it was one way of coping with what happened in the war, and then she now had to cope with humiliation as well.
And I think with Christine it's quite similar. I mean, she didn't tend to drink herself, but she did have a very difficult life. Well, sadly, an incredibly tragically short life after the end of the war.
Coming back to you were writing about extraordinary women who did extraordinary things, but there were an awful lot of very ordinary women around Europe who did extraordinary things as well, but in a simpler way.
Tell us about, I mean, with André as well, I mean, you heard a little bit about the honours that Virginia was afforded, and your mother eventually did receive some of the very highest honours.
Yes. Well, she got the Croix de Guerre in 1944.
Yeah.
So she got the Médaille de la Résistance, which was de Gaulle's personal award, in 1945. But she didn't get the Legion of Honour until 1995. And the reason for that was because she was a woman. There's no other way to explain it. The men needed their medals because they had careers. They wanted to get into politics. And so they all went first. And that's the explanation.
At least in France, the honours are the same for men and women. I don't know, but in Britain, the women received the civilian equivalents to the military medals that the men were given. So they didn't get
for doing the same job.
For doing exactly the same job. Being trained in
in the same system, putting their life on the line, armed, exactly the same. But the women were given the civilian equivalents to the male military honours, because in the British system, women couldn't receive military honours. And Pearl Witherington, of course, another fantastic, a really high-achieving woman who was dropped in with SOE, who led an army of a huge amount of men, Mackie men, into battle and did great work in the run-up to D-Day. She was given the civilian equivalents, and her line was, "There's nothing remotely civil about what I did." I'm afraid with that, it's time for us to round up. I suppose what these books have made really clear is that there are a lot of factors to becoming a successful agent or member of the resistance, but it's not about necessarily whether you're highly trained and extraordinary or an ordinary woman who rises to an extraordinary challenge. And it's not about whether you've got a prosthetic leg or not, or if you're male or female. It's about your skills, your motivation, and resilience, and a certain amount of luck as well. But I don't know, we tend to be put on these panels, sometimes I say, oh, that's good, that's a good women's history one. I just want to say it is women's history, and women's history is actually history. And it's really important history in this case as well. So please do go and get the books about these fantastic women you've been hearing around, and please help me to thank our wonderful guest today. So,